This is Audible.
A long time ago, in a galaxy far, far away.
Random House Audio presents Star Wars, A New Dawn, by John Jackson Miller. Read for you by Mark Thompson. For 1,000 generations, the Jedi Knights brought peace and order to the Galactic Republic, aided by their connection to the mystical energy field known as the Force. But they were betrayed, and the whole galaxy has paid the price. It is the age of the Empire. Now, Emperor Palpatine, once Chancellor of the Republic and secretly a Sith follower of the dark side of the Force, has brought his own peace and order to the galaxy. Peace through brutal repression, and order through increasing control of his subjects' lives. But even as the Emperor tightens his iron grip, others have begun to question his means and motives. And still others, whose lives were destroyed by Palpatine's machinations, lay scattered about the galaxy, like unexploded bombs waiting to go off. Years earlier, "It's time for you to go home," Obi-Wan Kenobi said. The Jedi Master looked at the blinking lights on the panel to his right, and then at the students watching him. The aisle between the towering computer banks and the central security station was designed for a few Jedi doing maintenance, not a crowd. But the younglings fit right in, afraid to jostle one another in the presence of their teacher for the morning. "That's the meaning of this signal," the bearded man said, turning again to the interface. Rows of blue lights twinkled in a sea of green indicators. He toggled a switch. "You can't hear anything now, or see anything. Not here in the Jedi Temple. But away from Coruscant, on planets across the galaxy, those of our order would get the message. Return home." Sitting on the floor with his classmates in the central security station, young Caleb Doom listened, but not intently. His mind wandered, as it often did, when he tried to imagine being out in the field. He was lean and wiry now, ruddy skin and blue eyes under a mop of black hair. He was just one of the crowd, not yet apprenticed to a mentor. But one day, he'd be out there, traveling to exotic worlds with his master. They'd provide peace and order for the citizens of the Galactic Republic, defeating evil wherever he found it. Then he saw himself later, as a Jedi Knight, fighting alongside the Republic's clone warriors against the enemy separatists. Sure, Republic Chancellor Palpatine had promised to resolve the war soon, but no one could be so rude as to end the war before Caleb got his chance. And then, finally, he dared hope he would become a Jedi Master, like Obi-Wan, accepted while still young as one of the wise sages of the Order. Then he'd really do some great feats. He'd lead the valiant battle against the Sith, the legendary evil counterpart to the Jedi. Of course, the Sith hadn't been seen in 1,000 years, and he knew of no shadow of their return. But in his ambitions, Caleb was no different from the younglings around him, whatever the gender, whatever the species. The adolescent imagination knew no bounds. The sandy-haired Jedi Master touched the panel again. "It's just in test mode now," Obi-Wan said. "No one will respond. But were there a true emergency, Jedi could receive the message in several ways." He glanced down at his listeners.
"There is the basic alert signal, and then there are other components in which you might find more detailed text and holographic messages. No matter the format, the basic purpose should be clear.
Go home!
The collected student shouted.
Obi-Wan nodded. Then he saw a hand being raised.
The student in the back, he said, fishing for a name. Caleb Doom, right?
Yes, Master.
Obi-Wan smiled. I'm learning too. The students giggled.
You have a question, Caleb?
Yes.
The boy took a breath.
Where?
Where what?
The other pupils laughed again, a little louder this time.
Where's home? Where do we go?
Obi-Wan smiled.
To Coruscant, of course. Here to the Jedi Temple. The recall is exactly what it sounds like.
The teacher started to turn back to the beacon when he spotted Caleb Doom jabbing his hand in the air again. Caleb wasn't one to sit in front for every lesson. No one respected a teacher's pet. But shyness had never been one of his afflictions.
Yes, Caleb?
Why?
The boy's voice cracked to mild chuckles from his companions. He glared at the others and started again.
Why would you need all the Jedi here at once?
A very good question. Looking at this place, one would think we had all the Jedi we need.
Obi-Wan grinned at the students' masters, all standing outside in the more spacious control room, looking in. Out of the corner of his eye, Caleb could see Depa Balaba among them. Tan-skinned and dark-haired, she had shown interest in taking him on as her apprentice, and she studied him now from afar with her usual, mostly patient look.
What are you on about now, Caleb?
Caleb had wanted to shrink into the floor then, when Obi-Wan addressed him directly.
Why don't you tell me, Caleb? What reasons would you expect would cause us to recall every Jedi in the Order?
Caleb's heart pounded as he realized everyone was watching him. In his daily life, the boy never worried about being hassled for sounding off. The kids he regularly trained with knew he never backed down. But there were students in the gathering he'd never seen before, including older ones. Not to mention the Jedi Masters. And Caleb had just blundered into a chance to impress a member of the High Council in front of everyone. Or it was a chance to founder on the question and take their abuse. There were so many possibilities, including a trick question.
I know the reasons you'd call them back, Caleb finally said. Unexpected reasons.
Riotous laughter erupted from the others, all semblance of respectful order disappearing at Caleb's words. But Obi-Wan raised his hands.
That's as good an answer as I've ever heard.
The group settled down, and Obi-Wan continued.
The truth, my young friends, is I simply don't know. I could tell you of the many times over the course of the history of the Order when Jedi have been called back to Coruscant to deal with one threat or another. Some perilous times, which resulted in great heroics. There are truths, and there are legends touched with truth. And all can teach you something. I'm sure Jocasta, our librarian, would help you explore more.
He clasped his hands together.
But no two events were alike. And when the signal is given again, that event will be unique too. It's my hope it will never be needed, but knowing about it is a part of your training. So the important thing is, when you get the signal...
Go home!
Very good.
Obi-Wan deactivated the signal and walked through the crowd to the exit. The students stood and filed back out into the control room, appreciating the wider space and chatting about their return to their other lessons. The field trip to this level of the Jedi Temple was over. Caleb stood too, but did not leave the aisle. The Jedi taught their students to look at all sides of things, and the thought occurred to him there was another side to what they'd just been shown. Brow furrowed, he started again to raise his hand. Then he realized he was the only one left. No one was looking or listening.
except Obi-Wan, standing in the doorway.
"What is it?" the master called out over the din.
Behind him, the others quieted, freezing in place.
"What is it, Caleb?"
Surprised to have been noticed, Caleb swallowed. He saw Master Balaba frowning a little, no doubt wondering what her impulsive prospect was on about now. It was a good time to shut up, but standing alone in the aisle between the banks of lights, he was committed.
"This beacon, it can send any message, right?"
"Ah," Obi-Wan said. "No, we wouldn't use it for regular administrative matters. As Jedi Knights, which I very much hope you will all become, you'll receive such instructions individually, using less dramatic forms of..."
"Can you send people away?"
A gasp came from the group. Interrupted, but not visibly irritated, Obi-Wan stared.
"I'm sorry?"
"Can you send people away?"
Caleb asked, pointing at the beacon controls.
"It can recall every Jedi at once. Could it warn all of them away?"
The room behind Obi-Wan buzzed with whispered conversations. Master Balaba stepped into the computer room, apparently wanting to put an end to an awkward moment.
"I think that's enough, Caleb. Excuse us, Master Kenobi. We value your time."
Obi-Wan wasn't looking at her. He was staring back at the beacon, too, now contemplating.
"No, no,"
he finally said, gesturing to the crowd without turning.
"Please, wait."
He scratched the back of his head and turned back to the gathering.
"Yes," he said quietly. "I suppose it could be used to warn Jedi away."
The students fairly rumbled with discussions in reaction.
"Warn Jedi away? Jedi didn't run. Jedi rushed toward danger."
"Jedi stood. Jedi fought."
The other masters stepped in, beckoning to Obi-Wan.
"Students," said one elder, "there's no reason to..."
"No expected reason," Obi-Wan said, pointing his index finger to the air.
He sought Caleb's gaze.
"Only what our young friend said. Unexpected reasons."
A hush fell over the group. Caleb, reluctant to say anything else, let another student ask what he was thinking.
"What then? If you send us all away, what then?"
Obi-Wan thought for a moment, before turning toward the students and giving a warm and reassuring smile.
"The same as any other time. You will obey the directive and await the next one."
Raising his arms, he dismissed the assembly.
"Thank you for your time."
The students filed out of the control room quickly, still talking. Caleb remained, watching Obi-Wan disappear through another doorway. His eyes turned back to the beacon. He could sense Master Balaba watching him. He looked back to see her alone, waiting in the doorway. The frown was gone. Her eyes were warm and caring. She gestured for him to follow her. He did.
"My young strategist has been thinking again,"
she said as they stepped into the elevator.
"Any other questions?"
"Await orders."
Caleb gazed at the floor, and then up at her.
"What if orders never come? I won't know what to do."
"Maybe you will."
"Maybe I won't."
She watched him, thoughtful.
"All right, maybe you won't. But anything is possible,"
she said, putting her arm on his shoulder as the door opened.
"Perhaps the answer will come to you in another form."
Caleb didn't know what that meant. But then it was Master Balaba's way to speak in riddles. And as always, he forgot about them as soon as he stepped out onto the floor where the young Jedi trained.
On any given day, room after room would see the mightiest warriors in the galaxy teaching the next generation in lightsaber combat, acrobatics, hand-to-hand fighting, even starship piloting using simulators. Every discipline imaginable where a kinship with the mystical force, the energy field all Jedi drew upon for strength, could come in handy. And those he saw were just a tiny fraction of the Jedi Order, which had outposts and operatives throughout the known galaxy. True, the Galactic Republic was at war now with the Separatists, but the Jedi had thwarted threats for 1,000 generations. How could anyone or anything challenge them? Caleb arrived in front of a room where his classmates were already at work, sparring with wooden staffs. One of his regular dueling partners, a red-skinned humanoid boy, met him in the doorway, training weapon in hand. He had also attended the lecture.
"Welcome, young Master Sirius," he said, smirking. "What was all that back there with Master Kenobi?"
"Forget it," Caleb said, pushing past him into the room and reaching for his own training weapon. "It's nothing."
"But wait!"
The other boy's free hand shot up into the air, mimicking Caleb's questioning.
Ooh, call on me!"
"Yeah, you're gonna want to focus, buddy, because I'm gonna whip your tail." Caleb smiled and went to work.
"This is Obi-Wan Kenobi. Republic forces have been turned against the Jedi. Avoid Coruscant. Avoid detection. Stay strong. May the Force be with you."
Phase 1. Ignition.
"Emperor unveils ambitious plan for Imperial fleet expansion.
Count Vidian contributes star power to new industrial inspection tour.
Leftover unexploded ordnance from Clone Wars remains a concern."
Headlines, Imperial Holo News, Gorse Edition. Chapter 1.
"Sound collision!"
Only a moment earlier, the Star Destroyer had emerged from hyperspace. Now a cargo ship careened straight toward its bridge. Before ultimatum shields could be raised or cannons could be brought to bear, the approaching vessel abruptly veered upward. Ray Sloan watched, incredulous, as the wayward freighter hurtled above her bridge's viewport and out of sight. But not out of hearing. A tiny scraping ka-thump signaled it had just clipped the top of the giant ship's hull. The new captain looked back at her first officer.
"Damage?"
"None, Captain."
No surprise, she thought. It was surely worse for the other guy.
"These yokels act as if they haven't seen a Star Destroyer before."
"I'm sure they haven't," Commander Chamas said.
"They'd better get used to it."
Sloane observed the cloud of transports ahead of Ultimatum. Her enormous Imperial-class starship had arrived from hyperspace on the edge of the appointed safe approach lane, bringing it perilously close to what had to be the biggest traffic jam in the Inner Rim. She addressed the dozens of crew members at their stations.
"Stay alert! Ultimatum's too new to bring back with a scratched finish."
Thinking again, she narrowed her eyes.
"Send a message on the Mining Guild channel. The next moron that comes within a kilometer of us gets a turbo laser haircut."
"Aye, Captain."
Of course, Sloane had never been to this system either, having just attained her captaincy in time for Ultimatum Shakedown cruise. Tall, muscular, dark-skinned, and black-haired, Sloane had performed exceptionally from the start and ascended swiftly through the ranks. True, she was only substituting on Ultimatum, whose intended captain was serving on assignment to the Construction Committee. But how many others had helmed capital ships at 30? She didn't know. The Imperial Navy had been in existence by that name for less than a decade, since Chancellor Palpatine put down the traitorous Jedi and transformed the Republic into the Galactic Empire. Sloane just knew the days ahead would decide whether she got a ship of her own. This system, she'd been briefed, was home to something rare, a true astronomical odd couple.
Gorse, out the forward viewport, lived up to its reputation as perhaps the ugliest planet in the galaxy. Tidally locked to its parent star, the steaming mud ball had one side that forever baked. Only the permanently dark side was habitable, home to an enormous industrial city amid a landscape of strip mines. Sloan couldn't imagine living on a world that never saw a sunrise, if you could call sweating through an endless muggy summer night living. Looking off to the right, she saw the real jewel, Cinda, Gorse's sole moon. Almost large enough to be counted in Imperial record-keeping as a double planet with Gorse, Cinda had a glorious silver shine, as charming as its parent was bleak. But Sloan wasn't interested in the sights, or the travails of all the losers on Gorse. She started to turn from the window.
Make doubly sure the convoys are respecting our clearance zone, and inform Count Vidian we have...
Forget the old way!
Snapped a low baritone voice. The harshly intoned words startled everyone on the bridge, for they had all heard them before, just seldom in this manner. It was their famous passenger's catchphrase, quoted on many a business program during the Republic days, and still used to introduce his successful series of management aides now that he had moved on to government service. Everywhere, the Republic's old ways of doing things were being replaced. Forget the old way really was the slogan of the times. Sloan wasn't sure why she was hearing it now, however.
Count Vidian,
she stated, her eyes searching from doorway to doorway.
We were just setting up our safety perimeter. It's standard procedure.
Demetrius Vidian appeared in the entryway farthest from Sloan.
And I told you to forget the old way,
he repeated, although there was no doubting everyone had heard him the first time.
I heard you transmit the order for mining traffic to avoid you. It would be more efficient for you to back away from their transit lanes.
Sloane straightened.
The Imperial Navy does not back away from commercial traffic.
Vidian stamped his metal heel on the deck.
Spare me your silly pride. If it weren't for the Thorali this system produces, you'd only have a shuffle to captain. You are slowing production down. The old way is wrong.
Sloan scowled, hating to be talked down to on her own bridge. This needed to seem like her decision.
It's the Empire's Thorolide. Give them a wide berth. Chamas, back us a kilometer off from the convoy lanes, and monitor all traffic.
Aye, Captain.
Aye is right,
Vidian said. Each syllable was crisply pronounced, mechanically modulated and amplified so all could hear. But Sloane would never get over the strangest part, which she'd noticed when he'd boarded. The man's mouth never moved. Vidian's words came from a special vocal prosthetic, a computer attached to a speaker embedded in the silvery plating that ringed his neck. She'd once heard the voice of Darth Vader, the Emperor's principal emissary, while electronically amplified. The Dark Lord's much deeper voice still retained some natural trace of whatever was inside that black armor. In contrast, Count Vidian had reportedly chosen his artificial voice based on opinion research, in a quest to own the most motivational voice in the business sector. And since he had boarded her ship with his aides a week earlier, Vidian had shown no qualms about speaking as loudly as he felt necessary. About Ultimatum, her crew, and her. Vidian strode mechanically onto the bridge. It was the only way to describe it. He was as human as she was, but much of his body had been replaced. His arms and legs were armor-plated rather than sinflesh prosthetics. Everyone knew because he made little effort to hide them. His regal burgundy tunic and knee-length black kilt were his only nods to normal attire for a 50-ish lord of industry. But it was Vidian's face that attracted the most awkward notice. His flesh lost to the same malady that had once consumed his limbs and vocal cords,
Vidian covered his features with a synth skin coating. And then there were his eyes. Artificial constructs. Glowing yellow irises sitting in seas of red. The eyes appeared meant for some other species besides humans. Vidian had chosen them solely for what they could do. She could tell that now as he walked, glancing outside from convoy to convoy, ship to ship, mentally analyzing the whole picture.
"We've already met some of the locals," she said. "You probably heard the bump. The people here are..."
"Disorganized. It's why I'm here."
He turned and walked along the line of terminal operators until he arrived at the tactical station depicting all the ships in the area. He pushed past Cawley, the young human ensign, and tapped a command key. Then Vidian stepped back from the console and froze, seeming to stare blankly into space.
"My lord?"
Cawley asked, unnerved.
"I have fed the output from your screen to my optical implants. You may return to your work while I read."
The tactical officer did so, no doubt relieved, Sloane thought, not to have the cyborg hanging over his shoulder. Vidian's ways were strange, to be sure, but effective. And that was why he was on her ship. The one-time industrialist was now the Emperor's favorite efficiency expert. Gorse's factories produced refined thorolide, a rare strategic substance needed in massive quantities for a variety of Imperial projects. But the raw material these days came from Cinda, its moon. Hence the traffic jam of cargo ships crisscrossing the void between the two globes. The Emperor had dispatched Vidian to improve production, a job for which he was uniquely qualified. Vidian was known for squeezing the very last erg of energy, the very last kilogram of raw material, the very last unit of factory production from one world after another. He was not in the Emperor's closest circle of advisors. Not yet. But it was clear to Sloane he soon would be, provided there was no relapse of whatever ailment it was that had brought him low years earlier. Vidian's billions had bought him extra life, and he seemed determined that neither he nor anyone else waste a moment of it. Since he boarded, she hadn't had a conversation with him where he hadn't interrupted at least a dozen times.
"We've alerted the local mining guild to your arrival, Count. The thorolite production totals..."
"Are already coming in,"
Vidian said, and with that he marched to another data terminal in the aft section of the bridge. Commander Chamas joined her far forward, many meters away from the Count. In his late 40s, Chamas had been leapfrogged in rank by several younger officers. The man loved gossip too much.
"You know," Chamas said quietly, "I heard he bought the title."
"Are you surprised? Everything else about him is artificial,"
Sloane whispered.
"Ship's doctor even thinks some of his parts were voluntarily..."
"You waste time wondering,"
Vidian said, not looking up from where he was studying. Sloane's dark eyes widened.
I'm sorry, my lord."
"Forget the formality and the apology. There is little point for either. But it's well for your crew to know someone is always listening and may have better ears than yours."
"Even if they had to buy them in a store,"
Sloane thought. The ragged, fleshy lobes that had once been Vidian's ears had special hearing aids. They could obviously hear her words, and more. She approached him.
"This is exactly what I'd expected,"
Vidian said, staring at whatever unseen thing was before his eyes.
"I told the Emperor it would be worth sending me here."
A number of underproducing worlds that manufactured items critical to the security of the Empire had been removed from their local governor's jurisdictions and placed under Vidian's authority. Gorse was the latest.
"Messy work might have been good enough for the Republic, but the Empire is order from chaos. What we do here, and in thousands of systems just like this one, brings us closer to our ultimate goal."
Sloane thought for a moment.
"Perfection?"
whatever the Emperor wants.
Sloan nodded.
Ah!
A tinny squawk came from Vidian's next speaker, an unnerving sound she'd learned to interpret as his equivalent of an angry sigh.
There's a laggard holding up the Moonward convoy,
he said, staring into nothingness. Looking at her tactician screen, Sloane saw it was the cargo vessel that had bumped them earlier. She ordered ultimatum turned to face it. A shower of sparks flew from the freighter's underside. Other vessels hung back, fearful it might explode.
Hail the freighter, she said.
A quavering, non-human voice was piped onto the bridge.
This is Cinder dreaming. Sorry about that scrape earlier. We weren't expecting.
Sloane cut to the point.
What's your payload?
Nothing yet. We were heading to pick up a load of thorolite on the moon for refining at Caladan Chemworks down on Gorse.
Can you haul in your condition?
We need to get to the repair shop to know. I'm not sure how bad it is. It could be a couple of months.
Vidian spoke up.
Captain, target that vessel and fire.
It was almost idly stated, to the extent that Vidian's intonations ever conveyed much genuine emotion. The directive nonetheless startled Chamas. Standing before the gunnery crew, he turned to the captain for guidance. The freighter pilot, having heard the new voice, sounded no less surprised.
I'm sorry. I didn't get that. Did you just...
Sloane looked for an instant at Vidian, and then at her first officer.
Fire!
The freighter captain sounded stunned.
What? You can't be...
This time, Ultimatum's turbo lasers provided the interruption. Orange energy ripped through space, turning Cinder dreaming into a confusion of fire and flak. Sloane watched as the other ships of the convoy quickly rerouted. Her gunners had done their jobs, targeting the ship in a way that resulted in minimal hazard for the nearby ships. All the freighters were moving faster.
You understand,
Vidian said, turning toward her.
Replacement time for one freighter and crew in this sector is...
3 weeks, Sloane said. Which is less than 2 months. See, I've read your reports too, Sloane thought.
This was the way to handle this assignment, she realized. So what if Vidian was strange? Figuring out what the Emperor and those who spoke for him wanted, and then providing it, was the path to success. Debating his directives only wasted time and made her look bad. It was the secret of advancement in the service. Always be on the side of what is going to happen anyway. Sloane clasped her arms behind her back.
We'll see that the convoys make double time. And challenge any ship that refuses.
It isn't just transit. There are problems on the ground, too. On planet and moon. Surveillance speaks of unruly labor, of safety and environmental protests, and there's always the unexpected.
Sloane clasped her arms behind her back.
Ultimatum stands at your service, my lord. This system will do what you... what the Emperor requires of it.
So it will,
Vidian said, eyes glowing blood red.
So it will.
Harris and Dula watched from afar as the scattered remains of the freighter burned silently in space. No recovery vehicles were in sight. As unlikely a prospect as survivors were, no one looked for any. There were only the shipping convoys quickly rerouting around the wreckage, obeying the Master's whip. This was mercy in the time of the Empire, she thought. The Imperials had none. Now, to all appearances, their lack of care was infecting the people. The green-skinned Twi'lek in her stealth-rigged starship didn't believe that was true. People were basically decent. One day, they would rise up against their unjust government. But it wouldn't happen now. And certainly not here. It was too soon. And Gorse was barely awake politically. This wasn't a recruitment trip. No.
these days were foreseeing what the Empire could do. A project that suited the ever-curious Hera perfectly. And Count Vidian, the Emperor's miracle man, practically begged investigation. In previous weeks, the Imperial Fixer had cut a swath through the sector, improving efficiency. On three previous worlds, like-minded acquaintances of Hera's on the Holonet had reported misery levels skyrocketing under Vidian's electronic eyes. Then her associates had simply vanished. That had piqued Hera's interest, and learning of the Count's visit to the Gorse system brought her the rest of the way. She had another contact on Gorse, one who had promised much information on the regime. She wanted that information. But first, she wanted to check out Vidian. And the system's notoriously anarchic mining trade offered her a variety of chances to get close. Industrial confusion, the perfect lure for Vidian, would provide excellent cover for her to study his methods. Emperor Palpatine had too many minions with great power and influence. It was worth finding out whether Count Vidian had real magic before he rose any higher. It was time to move. She picked out the identifying transponder signal of a ship in the convoy. One button push later, her ship was that vessel, as far as anyone trying to watch traffic was concerned. With practiced ease, she weaved her freighter into the chaotic flood of cargo ships heading to the moon. None of these guys can fly worth a flip, she thought.
It was just as well it wasn't a recruiting trip. She probably wouldn't have found anyone worth her time.
Chapter 2.
Look out, you big idiot! Seeing the bulky Thorolite hauler coming right at him, Kanan Jarrus forgot about talking and abruptly banked his freighter. He didn't waste time worrying whether the bigger vessel would veer in the same direction. He took his chance while the choice was still his. He was rewarded with survival and an alarmingly up-close look at the underbelly of the oncoming ship.
Sorry,
crackled a voice over the comm system. You sure are, Kanan said, blue eyes glaring from beneath dark eyebrows.
I see that guy in an alley tonight. He'd better watch out.
It was madness. Cinda's elongated elliptical orbit meant the distance between the moon and Gorse changed daily. Close approach days, like today, made the region between the worlds a congested demolition derby. But the appearance of the Star Destroyer and its destruction of the cargo ship had created a stampede in space. A race with two terrified groups bound in opposite directions, hurtling toward each other in the same transit lanes. Normally, Kanan would be the one pushing the limits to get where he was going. That was what kept him in drinking money, the main reason he had a job. But he also prided himself on keeping his cool when others were panicking. And that was surely happening now. Kanan had seen a Star Destroyer before, but he was pretty sure no one else around here had. Another freighter moved alongside. He didn't recognize this one. Almost shaped like a gem, with a bubble-like cockpit forward and another for a gunner seated just above. It was a nice ride compared with anything else in the sky. Kanan goosed the throttle, trying to pull alongside and get a glimpse at her driver. The freighter responded by zipping ahead with surprising speed, claiming his vector and causing him to lay off the acceleration. He gawked as the other pilot hit the afterburners, soaring far ahead. It was the one time he touched the brakes all trip, and it was instantly noticed. His comm system chirped, followed by a female voice sounding none too happy.
You there! What's your identifier?
Who's asking?
This is Captain Sloan of the Star Destroyer Ultimatum.
I'm impressed,
Kanan said, smoothing the black hairs on his pointed chin.
What are you wearing?
What?
I'm just trying to get a picture. Hard to meet people out here.
I repeat, what's your...
This is Expedient, flying for Moonglow Polychemical out of Gorse City.
He rarely bothered to activate his ID transponder. No one ever managed space traffic here anyway.
Speed up, or else,
Kanan sat lazily back in his pilot seat and rolled his eyes.
You can shoot me if you want, he said in a slow, almost drawl. But you need to know I'm hauling a load of explosive-grade beradium bisulfate for the mines on Cinda. It's testy stuff. Now, you might be safe from the debris in your big ship over there, but I can't speak for the rest of the convoy, and some of these folks are hauling the same thing I am, so I'm not sure how smart that'd be. He chuckled lightly. Be something to watch, though.
Silence. Then, after a moment,
move along.
Are you sure? I mean, you could probably record it and sell.
Don't push it, Grubber, and try to go faster.
He straightened one of his fingerless gloves and smiled.
Nice talking with you, too.
Ultimatum out.
Kanan switched off the receiver. He knew there wasn't any chance of his being targeted once anyone with a brain understood what he was carrying. For their own protection, miners only used Baby, the sardonic nickname for beradium bisulfate, by the gram down in the mines on Cinda. Any Imperial would think twice before targeting a baby carrier too close by. And the Star Destroyer captain in particular would be less apt to call on him again about anything after that conversation. That was also according to plan. He'd rather avoid that meeting no matter what she might look like. He mouthed Sloane's words mockingly.
Go faster.
He was already flying the freighter at close to top speed. When fully loaded, Expedient wasn't going to give him even that much. The sarcastic name was his idea. The freighter was Moonglow's, one of dozens of identical vessels the company operated. The ships met with disastrous ends often enough, the firm didn't bother naming them. Suicide flyers didn't stay in the game long, either, provided they survived. So Kanan had no idea how many people had flown his ship before him. Giving the baby carrier a name was just his attempt to give it even a single amenity. It'd be nice, he thought, if on one of the planets he visited, he could fly something with some class. Like that ship that had just raced past him. But then, whoever owned it probably wouldn't let him take the liberties he did with Expedient. Like now, seeing two mining haulers heading right for him, he'd banked the ship, corkscrewing between them. They slowed down. He kept on going. Let them watch out for me. His carefully secured payload didn't react to the sudden motion, but the maneuver did produce a dull thump from back in the cargo area. He turned his head, a short clump of tied back hair brushing against the headrest. Through the corner of his eye, Kanan saw an old man on the deck, half swimming against the floor as he tried to get his bearings.
Morning, Okadiah.
The man coughed. Like Kanan, Okadiah had a beard but no mustache, but his hair was completely white. He'd been sleeping back with the beradium bisulfate containers on the one empty shelf. Okadiah preferred that to the acceleration couch in the main cabin. It was quieter. Figuring out which way was forward, the old man started to crawl. He addressed the air as he reached the co-pilot's seat.
I've determined I will not pay your fare, and you shall have no tip.
Best tip I ever got was to pick another line of work, Kanan said.
Actually, Okadiah Garson had several lines of work, all of which made him the perfect friend to have in Kanan's eyes. Okadiah was foreman for one of the mining teams on Cinda, a 30-year veteran who knew his way around. And down on Gorse, he ran the asteroid belt, a cantina favored by many of his own mining employees. Kanan had met Okadiah months earlier when he'd broken up a brawl at his bar. It was through Okadiah that Kanan had gotten the freighter pilot job with Moonglow. Even now, Kanan lived in the flophouse next door to the cantina. A landlord with a liquor supply was a good deal indeed. Okadiah claimed he only partook of his own ferments when someone got hurt in the mines. That was a handy conviction to have, considering it happened nearly every day. Yesterday's cave-in had been so bad, it kept the party going all night long, causing Okadiah to miss his ship's personnel shuttle. Baby carriers didn't get many passengers who had any other options for getting to work, and Kanan didn't take riders. But for Okadiah, he made an exception.
"I dreamed I heard a woman's voice," the old man said, rubbing his eyes. "Stern, regal, commanding."
"Starship, Captain."
"I like it," Okadiah said. "She's no good for you, of course, but I am a man of means. When do I meet this angel?"
Kanan simply jabbed a thumb out the window to his left. There, the old man beheld Ultimatum, looming behind the frenetic rush of space traffic. Okadiah's bloodshot eyes widened, and then narrowed, as he tried to determine exactly what it was he was looking at.
"Hmm," he finally said. "That wasn't there yesterday."
"It's a Star Destroyer."
"Oh, dear. Are we to be destroyed?"
"I didn't ask," Kanan said, grinning. He didn't know how an old miner on an armpit like Gorse had come by his genteel manner of speech, but it always amused him.
"Somebody got on the wrong side of her. Know anyone on Cinda dreaming?"
Okadiah scratched his chin.
"Part of the Caladan crew. Tall fellow. Skinny hammerhead. He's run up quite a tab at the asteroid belt."
"Well, you can forget about collecting."
"Oh?"
Okadiah said, looking again out the window. There was still a bit of debris from the unlucky freighter about.
"Kanan, lad, you do have a way of sobering a person up."
"Good. We're almost there." Expedient rolled and angled downward toward the white surface of airless Cinda. An artificial crater had been hollowed out as a landing approach zone. Half a dozen red-lit landing bays had been gouged into its sides, connecting with the mining areas farther below. Bringing Expedient to hover over the crater, Kanan turned the ship toward his appointed entrance. Okadiah turned his head forward and squinted.
"There's my transport now."
"Told you we'd catch up."
They had caught up, but it wasn't purely from Kanan's efforts. The Empire's unreasonable directive had played a role. The personnel transport Okadiah was supposed to have been on had attempted to enter the bay too quickly, and it clipped the side of the doorway. Now it sat blocking the entrance, disabled and partially hanging over the edge. It was in no danger of falling, but the magnetic shield that would seal the cavern against the void could not be activated. Space-suited workers were visible in the bay, staring haplessly at the wreck.
"Move it," Kanan said over the comm.
"Stay put, Moonglow 72.
Crackled the response from the control tower at the center of the crater.
"We'll get you in after we get the workers suited and offloaded."
"I'm on a schedule,"
Kanan said, shifting Expedient out of the hover mode and moving toward the entrance. Objections came loudly over the communicator, getting Okadiah's attention. He glanced at Kanan.
"You are aware we're carrying high explosives?"
"I don't care," Kanan said.
"Do you?"
"Not at all. Sorry to disturb. Carry on."
Kanan did, expertly bringing Expedient's stubby nose toward the exposed side of the personnel carrier. He could see the miners inside its windows, clamoring futilely at him as his ship made contact with a clang. Expedient's engine straining, Kanan gunned the ship forward, dislodging the personnel transport from the edge. The noisy scrape reverberated through both vessels, and Okadiah glimpsed nervously back into the cargo section. But in moments, both ships were inside the landing area. The magnetic shield sealed the landing bay, and Kanan deactivated his engines. Okadiah whistled. He regarded Kanan with mild wonderment for a moment, and then placed his hands on the dashboard before him.
"Well, that's that."
He paused, seemingly confused.
"We drink after work, is that correct?"
"That's right."
"Entirely the wrong order," the old man said, wobbling slightly as he rose. Let's get to it, then.
Chapter 3. The horn-headed Deveronian miner charged from the disabled personnel transport across the pressurized cavern's floor.
You punk kid!
He yelled as Kanan exited Expedient.
What were you trying to prove back there?
Kanan was still in his early 20s, but he hadn't answered to kid ever. And certainly not when the name came from a dunderhead like Yelkin, whose job it was to drill holes for explosives. Kanan turned and walked alongside his ship, opening up cargo hatches as he went. The muscular miner stomped after him and grabbed at his shoulder.
I'm talking to you!
With quick reflexes, Kanan grabbed Yelkin's hand and spun around, twisting the other man's arm.
Yelkin winced in pain and fell to his knees.
Kanan didn't let go. He spoke in low, calm tones into his captive's pointed ear.
Your ship was in the way, pal. I have a deadline.
We all do,
Yelkin said, struggling.
You saw them shoot that freighter. The Empire's come to check.
Then go faster, but don't go stupid.
Kanan released his hold, and Yelkin fell to the ground, gasping. Kanan brushed off his long-sleeved green tunic and turned back to Expedient. Several miners arrived at Yelkin's side.
Blasted suicide flyer, one said. They're all cracked.
Someone needs to show you some manners,
another said to Kanan.
So I've heard.
Unworried, Kanan looked around the landing bay. The loader droids that normally helped hadn't arrived, evidently unable to make sense out of the impromptu parking situation on the loading floor. It looked like it was going to be another one of those days when he had to do everything. Kanan unloaded a hovercraft and parked it in front of the ship. Then he began the laborious process of hefting down metal crates. Cinda's lesser gravity made the cases somewhat lighter than they had been on Gorse, but no less bulky or hazardous to carry.
Heaving the first crate, he carried it toward the milling miners.
You're in the way,
he said.
For the moment.
Okadiah appeared on the far side of the spacecraft.
Gentlemen, I think a maxim is in order. Do not aggravate the man who carries high explosives.
The miners parted, glowering at Kanan as he passed. Rubbing his arm, Yelkin snarled at Okadiah.
You taking some real pieces of work, boss.
Like I did all of you one time or another,
the old man said. He pointed toward the south and a bank of elevators.
Let's get the shift started. If the Empire's inspecting today, Boss Lal will be here too. At least pretend to work.
He smiled toothily.
And let me add, in honor of that poor sap outside who got himself blown to smithereens, it'll be happy hour all night tonight at the asteroid belt. We'll even pick you up and drive you home.
Momentarily assuaged, the miners turned and made for the elevators. Okadiah watched Kanan set a case down on the hovercart.
Still winning friends and influence?
Don't know why I'd do that, Kanan said.
Ah, yes. You're not staying. Like you told me, you never stay.
Clothes on my back,
Kanan said as he turned to grab another crate.
Travel light, and death will never find you.
I said that, didn't I?
Okadiah nodded.
You'll work the bar tonight?
If you can afford it.
Okadiah winked and ambled off after his co-workers. Kanan did keep the bar on occasion, but on some nights he was his own best customer. He'd also tried his hand as bouncer, although, again, he'd wound up starting as many fights as he'd stopped. Still, this system had been closer to a home than any he'd known in years of wandering. It would be a hard place to leave. But he would. The day job was wearing on him. Giving up on the loader droids ever arriving to help, Kanan finished filling the first hover cart and pushed it into the freight elevator. As the doors closed behind him, he thought on it. He might miss Okadaya's place, yes, and he'd certainly miss Cinda. In all his travels, he'd never encountered a place quite like it. The landing bay didn't look like much, but he knew to watch for the big show as soon as the elevator doors opened. They did, 1,000 meters below, and Kanan was bombarded with a coruscating display of lights and colors. He was in one of the countless great caverns beneath the surface. Crystal stalagmites climbed and stalactites hung all around. Each one acted as a prism, refracting the lights of the work crew. To move was to see kaleidoscopic change. Better still, the crystals gave off warmth, making Cinda's many oxygenated caverns as bright and pleasant as parent planet Gorse was dark and sticky. Back before the Empire, the place had been a natural preserve. Cinda had been the literal bright spot in the lives of Gorse's residents. Tourism had been the moon's and Gorse's number one draw. And while Republic scientists had learned early on that Cinda's interior contained massive amounts of thorolide, no one had wanted to mine for it while the workable night side of Gorse still held any of the substance at all. As far as Kanan knew, no one even bothered looking for thorolide on Gorse's day side, where the heat was enough to melt any droid in manufacture. But then, almost exactly on the day that Chancellor Palpatine proclaimed the first galactic empire, a report had revealed that Gorse's mines were exhausted. The refineries went idle. The Empire wouldn't stand for it, and didn't need to. Cinda was right there, readily available to exploit. Kanan saw the results now as he pushed the hover cart from the intact antechamber into the main work area. Pebble-sized crystal fragments littered the floor, and his boots crunched as he walked. Only the big industrial lights illuminated the cavity. The ceiling couldn't be seen at all in the smoky haze above. A sickly burnt stench hung on the air. The Empire had defiled the place, but it could hardly resist. Useful as thorolide was in its processed form, in nature, it had a fragile molecular structure. Efforts to free the substance from comets, already an insanely difficult process, often resulted in the collapse of the compound into its component elements. But Cinda was the mother lode in more ways than one, for its tough crystal columns managed to preserve thorolide inside them, even when blasted from their bases. Given how the prismatic structures reacted to laser torches, blasting was the only way. The need for explosives had given Kanan a job, but it had also given Gorsians cause to object. Some were more vocal than others, and a few were downright loud about it. Like that guy, Kanan thought, recognizing a voice coming from the far end of the work zone.
Oh, brother Skelly.
You're not listening,
the red-headed man declared, gray dust puffing from his protective vest as he waved his arms.
You're not listening!
In the perfect echo chamber the cavern provided, no one could help but hear Skelly. And if there were any stalactites left intact, Kanan half expected Skelly's voice to bring them down. But Kanan saw that the target of Skelly's harassment wasn't paying much mind, and he couldn't blame her. A four-armed, green-skinned member of Gorse's Besalisk sub-community, Lal Gralik, was the enterprising chief of Moonglow Polychemical. Running it kept Boss Lal jumping from planet to moon and back. Skelly was just one more nuisance to deal with.
I am listening, Skelly,
she said.
I could probably hear you down on Gorse.
I'm sure she wishes she were there now, Kanan thought.
Short and compactly built, Skelly had one mode, intense. Kanan was vaguely aware of the 40-ish man's war record as a tunneler. The scars and pockmarks on his face read like a walk through recent military history. But while Kanan felt for anyone who'd gone through all that, he had little patience for the way Skelly always talked, as if he were trying to yell over a barrage.